I'm 21.
Skip the rhetoric, hip hip for Frederick. Frederick's fled his limitations.
Hear me out, brothers. My brothers do hear me.
Cheer him.
Changing direction.
Clearly.
And don't you unsteer me.
Hear me.
I'm bailing and sailing away today. I'm nailing down freedom today.
Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham, and I am thrilled to welcome a gentleman who is a two-time Tony Award-winning songwriter and librettist for The Mystery of Edmund Drood. He's a Tony-nominated playwright for Say Goodnight, Gracie. He's also a recording artist with a number one Billboard hit to his credit, a pop songwriter with songs recorded by the likes of people like Barbara Streisand, as well as a best-selling novelist. And actually, I just actually coincidentally read his wonderful Murder Your Employer, The McMaster's Guide to Homicide. Coincidentally, I just read it like 2 months ago, and I highly recommend it. Welcome, Mr. Rupert Holmes.
Pleasure to be here. And I'm so, I saw my sales figures, and I didn't know that you were among them on the novel. Thank you.
I most certainly was.
Was there anyone you were? Is there any particular employer you were hoping to murder? Or
there were a couple I was considering. I was looking for some tips. When I saw the book on Amazon, I was like, oh, I might want to have that as a reference guide for future.
I think some people actually bought the hardcover. I mean, it's a New York Times bestseller, and I thought, are people really that cold-blooded? And then I thought, maybe some of them are just buying it to leave on their desk. just as a cautionary note to whoever.
I think that's a very strong possibility. If you are a mystery fan, or you just like incredibly clever, twisty books, mystery novels with unexpected turns, I love a mystery that takes you places where you don't expect it to go. And that's exactly what this book does, which is why I really, really loved it. I hope that there is a follow-up coming at some point.
I'm at work on it as I'm interrupting the sequel just to do this with you.
Perfect. Perfect. I have
priorities right. I have the right order.
Yes. Yes. But you are here. Yes. You are here actually to chat about this past season's Roundabout Theater revival of Gilbert and Sullivan's The Pirates of Penzance, which was retitled Pirates, the Penzance Musical. The reason you're on is because the Broadway cast recording of this revival, Tony-nominated revival, was actually already available digitally, but will be released on CD on Friday, November 14th, which is when this episode will begin streaming. It's a bonus episode of the Broadway Radio Show that we pulled together because Mr. Holmes was available. And you have extensive credits. It's available on Center Stage Records. I got to give a little plug to the record label.
Sure.
There are so few record labels that are still doing cast recordings, so we want to praise them to the heavens that they're still keeping these in, and also putting it out on CD, which is a big deal.
Yes.
But your credits on this particular revival are pretty extensive. I want to quote from the Playbill. Your credits include concept, new book, lyrics, arrangements, and musical adaptations. It's quite extensive. I know that this revised version was kind of in development for many years, dating pre-pandemic, I think, right?
Yeah.
So talk about how you initially became involved with this and how the development process kind of progressed over the years.
Well, the pandemic did play its part, and you say that rightfully, because it delayed us just as we were starting up. We had to all lock ourselves in our rooms. And by the way, while I was locked in my room, I wrote Murder Your Employer, because I suddenly theater had shut down all around the world. And I thought, good thing I have a contract with Simon & Schuster to write a novel, because otherwise I'd have a lot of free time here.
Mm-hmm.
But it originated actually out of an act of kindness by my beloved collaborator and friend, Scott Ellis, with whom Scott directed both the Roundabout Broadway revival of The Mystery of Edwin Drood, and with Warren Carlyle choreographing, who worked, did the brilliant choreographic work on Pirates. And he also directed Curtains, a musical that I wrote with Tander Neb. And if it weren't for Scott Ellis, that musical would never have come to exist. He just wouldn't leave the project alone, and he made it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And in this instance, Scott had seen online that I was getting an award from the New York Gilbert and Sullivan Players, of which my brother has been a fixture for some 30 years now. And he, out of kindness, he and the co-star with David Hyde Pierce of Curtains, Deb Monk, they both decided to come and pay to have a bad meal and to be and to clap their hands for me. And that was so nice of them. And in the course of the evening, a number of songs from Pirates of Penzance were sung. And Scott went home. This is all, he told me this in the years to follow. He went home and thought, I wonder how long it's been since Pirates of Penzance has been on Broadway. Is it due for a revival? He looked and saw, yes, indeed, it had been quite some time. The early 80s, the production with Linda Ronstadt, Kevin Kline, and George Rose. I had a kind of kinship with that production because many of the people in that production and its producer, Joe Papp, went on a few years later to produce my first musical, The Mystery of Edwin Drood. And I got George Rose from the cast in my show. He won the Tony Award for Best Actor in that. And the set designer, Bob Shaw, and the director and choreographer, Wilfred Leach and Graziella Danielle. Scott thought, started doing research on Pirates and thinking what new could be brought to the story. And by the time he called me about it, which was just before the pandemic, he had already, I think, decided that New Orleans would be an interesting relocation for the show because there had been, in fact, real pirates in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
Within Gilbert and Sullivan's stories, the fanciful pirates of Penzance turn out to be not actual pirates at all. They're English noblemen who are playing games at being pirates, which is maybe not the most satisfying ending. You know, it's probably going to not get you in any Ibsen festivals. But here in this country, we had real pirates. And what both Scott and I knew, even without researching, was that one of the fascinating things about Pirates of Penzance is that it made its world premiere, not in London, but in New York.
Yes.
Not very far from where the Roundabout Theater has its headquarters. And then we knew that it toured a little bit. And now I started piecing together, well, let me find, was there a production of Pirates of Penzance in New Orleans? And I found that there was one within a couple of years of its world premiere. And I felt that gave me artistic license to come up with this conceit that Gilbert and Sullivan are in New York, and they've been in New York. They've launched this Pirates of Penzance show in New York, Philadelphia, Boston. I actually have Gilbert and Sullivan come out at the beginning of the show and explain all this to the audience. And then I decided that if they went to New Orleans to do the show there, I found it hard to imagine that Gilbert wouldn't notice, out of some interest in local history, that there had been these real pirates, very colorful characters, but completely real, who had operated at times in tandem with the U.S. government. The government said, you know, if you want to sink any British ships during our war with England in 1812, you could go ahead. We'll look the other way. So I thought, well, there's that going for it. And then I thought, but wait, more important is, what is the principal export of New Orleans? And it was jazz. It's where, if anywhere was the birthplace of jazz, it's that city. Mm-hmm. And it was starting to foment in the time frame that Pirates of Penzance was first created. Full-blown jazz that we know of as big band jazz, that was still a long way off. But the beginnings of ragtime, the and of work songs and blues, that was in that area. And I thought, you know, I think Sullivan would be intoxicated by this. And the rhythms that are coming coming to New Orleans from Jamaica and from Haiti, and the Spanish influences from Mexico and South America, I thought, and it sort of seemed comfortably right to have these, to think of Sullivan saying, I want to redo the score and bring in some of these local elements, some of the local color. And Gilbert says, well, I'm going to rewrite the book a little bit to reflect these real pirates and some kind of history that ties in with the British struggle in New Orleans, the Battle of New Orleans, mm-hmm. which is the United States versus England. And we have a modern major general who may have fought in the Battle of New Orleans in New Orleans, you know. So it all seemed to make a lot of sense. And as we went farther and farther, you know, someone once said the rule of farce is that once you take a ridiculous premise, you must follow it religiously and honestly, or it won't be funny.
Yeah.
And so the more we took this idea, this silly idea, seriously, the more we found that things seemed to make sense. And Sullivan's music sounded just as good or maybe even more intoxicating to a contemporary audience dressed up in these jazz and rhythmic settings. And it just all seemed to come together that way.
Yeah, it's really interesting you say that. I mean, because that is one of the rules of farce, as you said, is that it has to be played seriously. The people, I mean, the actors and the characters have to believe what they're doing. It has to be played straight for it to be funny.
There's a brainy quote of mine. I'm not brainy, but I ended up there where I say, the thing you have to keep in mind with a farce is that the characters the characters having this dilemma do not have the comfort of knowing they're in a comedy.
Exactly.
So we can find it funny that they're having these terrible dilemmas, but for them, the stakes are very real and very high. And that is, as you are saying, a key to a comedy that doesn't take itself a little seriously, meaning that you don't believe in the dilemma, that to me is like playing tennis without a net.
We're sashaying through the old French Quarter, iron railings in the bricks and mortar, courtyard fountains, fountain cool, clear water by palmetto trees. Sweet! Nothing nicer than this promenading. Sun is high, but there is lots of shading. In the Mississippi, we'll be waiting right up to our knees. Meet!
Right.
looking back at Gilbert and Sullivan, especially something like Pirates, which is probably their most well-known title and probably their most revived title, is that if you mention Gilbert and Sullivan to your average modern theater goer, they're going to think of it as an operetta that's stodgy and old and out of date and probably hard to follow because, as you and I both know, and a lot of people who are theater fans will know, operetta musical style is very different musically and lyrically than modern musical theater, let alone it's different than Golden Age Broadway musical theater. It's written totally differently. And there's a kind of an aversion to sitting through Gilbert and Sullivan. It's just not, our ears can't handle it. And it's just not, and it's old fashioned, and the morals of it are different, and the class distinctions are different, and the gender distinctions are different.
Yep.
And so looking at it, I'm sure those were some of the considerations you guys were thinking of, not only resetting it in New Orleans and changing the influences of the music, but also your approach to rewriting the book and rewriting some of what was going on in the show was to also bring it to make it appealing and attuned to modern time, right?
Yeah. It was a wonderful actual opportunity for me, because by placing it in New Orleans, by saying Gilbert is still the author, but now he's been soaking up the local color and the local vocabulary, it allowed me to translate some of the more obscure references in the songs to contemporary, but to American.
Right.
And it just seemed to make a lot of sense to do that. First of all, Gilbert and Sullivan, what they launched with HMS Pinafore and Pirates of Penzance were the beginnings, but I'm saying the beginnings of what we came to call musical theater and musical comedy, which then became musical theater. And it didn't seem that wrong to allow some Golden Age musical comedy into the room with us, since they had fostered, they started it all. They really got the ball rolling. And then basically the United States, New York, Broadway ran with that idea and took the operetta thing, and suddenly it isn't an operetta. They always called their works operas. We call them operettas. I was trying to see if we could make it feel like you were seeing a revival of a classic musical comedy. Right. And I think they would have been very pleased to hear, and I'm not saying the show had to end, it was a limited run because the theater we were in had to undergo a renovation on a given date, and we couldn't extend beyond that date. But it would have done their hearts very much good to hear people roaring with laughter and tapping their feet and cheering the way they might a hit Broadway show, rather than the way we, you know, what is it? I had a line in The Mystery of Edwin Drood: I'm fond of chamber music, I take some every week, as if it's medicine. And no one was taking this as medicine. Usually when you go to Gilbert and Sullivan with your great aunt Mildred, you think, well, I'm going to go, here's 2 hours of my life or 2.5 hours of my life that I'll enjoy some of it. I'll appreciate it, but I probably won't go out humming the tunes.
Yes.
And we I think we're able to bring that dynamic to the show.
Yeah, I think that also the device of having Gilbert and Sullivan as characters at the beginning of the show allow you a lot of flexibility, because they set up the audience to understand that this is not going to be, and I'm going to use this, I'm using this in vain, but not in a disparaging way, but they're not sitting in for a doily cart version of Gilbert and Sullivan, which is the famous theater company that still does Gilbert and Sullivan revivals. They're not getting in for a traditional Gilbert and Sullivan revival. They're in for something new and different and much revised for their entertainment. And I think you're right, because people forget that Gilbert and Sullivan really were sort of the first transitional point between what we now consider grand opera and modern musical theater. And they considered themselves opera, but now we look back and look at them as sort of the beginnings of the operetta movement, which became much more, as people like Jerome Kern and Oscar Hammerstein and people like that, Otto Harbach and people like that got involved. It became a little bit less comic and became a little bit more melodramatic and romantic and big, and that went through its cycle. But ultimately, what you hear, especially what you hear on this cast recording, is you hear this beautiful blend between golden age musical comedy and, but still remnants of traditional Gilbert and Sullivan, because it's still there.
Yeah.
Right? All the pieces are still there.
Oh, absolutely. And you're absolutely right. A number of people, and when we were developing it, thought it was a mistake to have Gilbert and Sullivan come out at the beginning, and they were afraid they would lecture the audience. But in point of fact, their lecture was very funny and got a lot of laughs. But in addition to that, it sort of let us it let Gilbert and Sullivan give permission to this unique presentation of their work, because theoretically they're trying it just for fun themselves. Mm-hmm. And you know, James M. Cain, the novelist, was once asked, he wrote the novels from which there were movies like The Postman Always Rings Twice and Mildred Pierce and Double Indemnity. And someone once said, how do you feel about what Hollywood has done to your books? And he said, Hollywood's done nothing to my books. They're right behind me, you know, at this moment. In other words, this is not meant to replace Pirates at Penzance with the traditional orchestrations for the doily card opera. This is just a new way to look at it and hear it. And I actually think that there are going to be people who will appreciate Gilbert and Sullivan more if they were introduced to it with the show that we gave them this year. A lot of young people who would never in their lives ever think of hearing Gilbert and Sullivan, and they came away thinking, well, this was fun. Maybe there's more fun. And there is fun in the other works as well.
Yeah, there is. And I think that's one of the topics I wanted to talk to you about, is when you yourself dove into Pirates to start the revision.
Yeah.
Talk about some of the stuff that's actually, because I don't want people to think that Gilbert and Sullivan is just light fluff stuff. There's a lot of social commentary in their stuff. There's a lot of things that are going on that make the pieces funny, probably more funny to people at their time in England or in New York at the time the Pirates made its world premiere at the Fifth Avenue Theater. Yeah. But talk about some of the more the undertones, the subtext, yeah, that's there, that you still are bringing forth in the new version that you've written, that are pertinent to today's audiences. There's still stuff in there, that's the meat that's in there is still important for people to see, right?
Well, a good distillation of that can be found in the last number in the show, I think. I was having trouble figuring out how to end the story. The ending that Gilbert and Sullivan have would have been impossible for us to use.
Right.
Original Gilbert and Sullivan, the pirates defeat the police, but the police sergeant invokes the name of Queen Victoria, and they immediately say, oh, well, we didn't know we were being arrested under the name of Queen Victoria, and they submit completely. And then we have this further ending, which I'd mentioned, where we find out they're not actually really pirates at all. And it kind of a little ragged, you know, it was about time for the show to end at that point. And originally I thought, I've got to find a different ending tune, because they end on just a reprise of Poor Wandering One, which doesn't really, that's about the love story, but it isn't really about the whole world we've been in. And I thought, well, there was this famous sort of turning point, 11 o'clock song, not an 11 o'clock number, but a song in their previous musical, HMS Pinafore, called He Is an Englishman, which was always tongue-in-cheek. It was saying, one thing can be said for this fellow, this British sailor, is he decided to remain an Englishman. He could have been a Russian or a Prussian, but he chose to remain, which is the stupidest patriotism of all, because, of course, he didn't choose it. And Gilbert, who is very socially aware, had in his operetta Iolanthe, he had a similar character to the police sergeant, same vocal range, say, he finds it that very interesting that every boy and every girl that's born into this world alive is either a little liberal or else a little conservative, as if you're born that way and not raised that way to be that viewpoint. So I thought, well, how about we end with he is American, and I can sort of do an American version of that. And it didn't feel right. It felt like we were doing a kind of flag waving that isn't really that I'm not comfortable with right now.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, could I use a phrase as silly and as simple as "we're all from someplace else"? I thought that could be sort of the antithesis of a national anthem. As I thought, let me write an anthem for everywhere else other than where we are right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because that to me was what I loved about New Orleans was it was in its time, it was the second biggest seaport in the United States, but it was also the most egalitarian society in any city in the United States. And part of that was because there was so much intermarriage and so many people had been newly liberated and so many people had risen from lower ranks and become landowners in a good way. And the theater that I pictured this show being in was a real theater called, and it's named in the musical, you're being told that you're at the Theater of the Renaissance, which was a real theater in New Orleans, run by, owned and operated by three people of color, and where anyone with the price of a ticket could sit next to anybody else. And the people on stage were a reflection of their audience. Mm-hmm. And I thought, so that's what's beautiful about the Caribbean and the fact that New Orleans is actually not just a major southern city, but it is the northernmost city of the Caribbean. It's part of that culture as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows up in its cuisine and it is showing up in its music. So I thought, let me have them sing. Instead of saying he is an Englishman or he is an American, say he's from somewhere else and we're all getting along. We're all getting along. And to me, that made it the opposite of flag waving. It was waving everybody else's flags from everywhere, every other port of call that people come from. And it seemed a good time in our history to be reminded, not that we don't think about it a lot, but that we are just this hodgepodge. We are a nation of immigrants, and that's where our strength has always been drawn from.
Right.
And, so that's that number itself is a kind of distillation of the spirit that went into all of this, because the Pirate King's crew are from all over the seven seas. And they're in conflict with the British, and yet I have the Major General, someone who fought in the War of 1812, fighting against the United States, but so fell in love with the area, the region of the bayou, that he decided to retire there and bring all his daughters who were born all over the world as he served in various colonial posts for Britain, and bring them all to this one place where they have a better chance to rise through society.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of contemporary themes, basically sort of not hidden, but just woven through the fabric of this glorious score that Sullivan wrote.
Go back to where you came from? Are you mad? If we all went back to our family's homelands, this nation would be a wilderness where the buffalo roam and nobody's home. Even the ancestors of those native to this soil bravely ventured here from another continent millennia ago. This is the land of the clean slate, the blank canvas, the new beginning. With all our differences and misguided missions, there's only one thing that unites all of us who live here.
And what is that?
We're all from someplace else. You yourself once said it, and we're truly due some credit, that we're all from someplace else.
We're all from someplace else.
And not by chance or error, for we are some forbearer, once hailed from somewhere else.
Yes, they sailed from someplace else.
Scratchwork nation, 'cause we all are someplace.
the human race could well embrace, that we all trace from someplace else. We all come from someplace else. Beat the drum for.
Dear hearts, they were not from these here parts,
from unsung bays and beaches,
some thought long outer reaches,
and their past got rearranged,
and their last names all got changed,
and though no one here invited us, our distinctions have united us as the sum of some.
It's interesting because from a historical perspective, a lot of people look at the time, probably the time period, and look at New York and think, well, New York was the largest port. And people consider New York as like, well, the melting pot of the United States. But in reality, someplace like New Orleans in that time period was probably much more of a cultural and racial melting pot than New York ever was, because New York may have had immigrants from all over the world, but they were still segregated into their own neighborhoods and ghettos. But in New Orleans, they weren't as much. In New Orleans, there was so much intermarriage and the influences of all the cuisines and all that kind of stuff, and music and everything blended much more so than would happen in New York.
In many ways. I have Gilbert talk about the new version being a jambalaya. And of course, yes, you hit on the very right words. The fact there was so much intermarriage between people from so many different. So, and remember, that people who came from the Caribbean have had European descendants, so they are sort of, there was a kind of a drop off point where someone from Spain or France, that's why my Pirate King is named, has both a Spanish and a French name. So it seemed to me that we had a chance. And sometimes it takes someone who's new to a country to perceive what's so wonderful about that country. Mm-hmm. And Gilbert was always, he loved to poke fun at the social distinctions, class distinctions. He has the captain in his previous work, HMS Pinafore. The sailor cannot marry the captain's daughter because he's a lowly sailor and the captain is a fine captain. And then it turns out, and it's one of the silliest transitions ever, and it's beautiful because it's so quick, is so he's going to be, the sailor is going to be whipped with a cat of nine tails for having dared to even think of marrying a captain's daughter. And then it turns out that Buttercup, Little Buttercup, switched the babies at birth, and the captain is really the sailor.
Right.
And the sailor is really the captain. And instantly they come out with their uniforms changed. And now it's perfectly all right for the captain to marry the sailors, to marry that. So he loved to make fun of rank that way. And nowhere was the social ranking stronger than in England of that period. And so I thought he would take to this idea, that he would take to the fact that in New Orleans, it's hard to be prejudiced because you can't tell who anyone is by virtue of color.
Right.
You can't be sure if you're talking to a someone who came from Canada, that, you know,
Right.
So you got Cage, and you have French descendants. It just seemed like this was something that would tickle Gilbert's fancy, and it would be something that would make us feel more contemporary to us in terms of what the sensibilities we're trying to acquire.
And also part of a slightly different topic, but part of the doing revisions like this is you also have to cut characters, and you also have to cut songs.
Yes.
And you're also interpolating songs, because as you mentioned, you brought in a different ending.
Yep.
So you had to bring in a song from another show and write some new lyrics. So talk about that as well, because, I mean, sure. you know, there are plenty of Gilbert and Sullivan purists out there who, of course, will be like, oh, my God, they're desecrating Pirates of Penzance.
I have stomped on their toes, I'm sure. And I understand that they should understand, if they're listening, two things. One is, I am a Gilbert and Sullivan devotee. Mm-hmm. And if I'm going to have my Gilbert and Sullivan, generally I have it as it was written and orchestrated. But that's why I made the analogy to James M. Cain. And we haven't done anything to that Pirates, and Pirates will still continue to be, as you said, probably the most performed operetta, and it will be performed a lot as it was written. And a lot of people prefer that. So it's not like I don't understand that point of view. In retelling the story, just seeing, how about this? If I change the location, you know, if I set the Wizard of Oz in Depression, New York, things are going to change. You know, I mean, you're going to take some. So, for example, there were some things that, despite its magnificence as an operetta, that had always bothered me about Pirates of Penzance. And one of them is that the character of Ruth is very key to Act One and to the general dilemma that everyone is facing. But she sort of evaporates in Act Two. She's part of one trio, Paradox. And people I know, from having seen so many stagings of Pirates over the decades, people don't know what to do with Ruth at the end, because she doesn't have anyone to pair off with. Nothing. She hasn't grown. She was rejected by Frederick at the end of Act One, and there's no reconciliation between the two of them. She's just back to being a pirate, and now she's a pirate without. And she has to stand there while Frederick and Mabel have their happy ending. And she's supposed to be jolly about it. So I didn't like that. And I thought, so what do we do with Ruth in Act Two? And I said, well, let me steal from the source. And I went through the whole canon of Gilbert and Sullivan and was reminded of a lesser known song in Mikado, which has so many famous songs. Catashaw has a kind of lament called Alone and Yet Alive. And I looked at the first stirrings of the lyric by Gilbert, and it seemed almost like a torch song. It seemed like a kind of song that you might have found in a Sondheim musical, of a woman saying, I'm down and I'm defeated, but I'm not, I'm still here, and I've just got to live with this. I thought, with a rewrite of the lyric to reflect more specifically Ruth's dilemma, and to give it a kind of a torch song feel, like The Man That Got Away, Judy Garland's classic, maybe this could be a good emotional moment for Ruth, just on the stage alone, just that moment where a character is left alone on stage and they kind of say, and this is where life has left me, and I'm stuck with it, but I'm still going to plod on.
Alone and yet alive. Oh, Frederick, my soul is still my body's prisoner. I thought I'd die, but turns out no such luck. This brig called life is where you find me stuck. A well-plucked sitting duck. Tell me why now I linger still with prospects nil. Who crawls along when all's gone wrong? So giving I my happy end goodbye now. I had my shot. He loves me not. Why? From whence I wake till night nears, and with each breath I'm scared to death. I've still a plethora of years for shedding tears. Hearts do not mend, merely contend, barely pretending to try. My heart has failed, my ship has sailed, my coffin's nailed, but here am I just won't die. Here, living I, the dread of my survival, can't I perceive it's time to leave? I've loved in vain, so why remain the caregiving I? Who's dead upon a rifle? All hope is gone, yet I grow warm. The never dying, ever bruising, always trying, always losing, ever loving.
That seemed to be a terrific number for Jinx Monsoon to perform alone on a stage. Audience would go wild, and it led the way to a happier ending for Ruth that I kind of concocted. We sort of wrap up the plot very quickly at the end, but it all seems to make sense, and it all seemed to come out of the story we had told. Another instance was that, again, everyone who knows anything about patter songs, the number one patter song perhaps of all time is in Act One, the Modern Major General song, "I Am the Very Model of a Modern Major General." And David Hyde Pierce delivers it incredibly on the recording and endearingly every night on stage, and always added some improvisatory moment to it that we never knew what he was going to say in one very specific spot of the song. And he came up with something new at every performance, God bless him. But then in the original Pirates, you don't hear much from him again in Act Two. He has one kind of sad song about the willow, which is very poorly placed just before the end of the show, which is not where you want a slow ballad, about nothing. So I looked at this, I looked at Act Two specifically focusing on the Major General. And I said, well, the beginning of Act Two, he can't sleep. His daughters find him awake when he should be in bed because he's haunted by guilt over the fact that he's told the pirates a lie to save his own skin. and to save their skin as well. I thought, so he can't sleep. Well, my personal favorite patter song of all time is an Iolanthe. From Gilbert and Sullivan. And it's known as the Nightmare Song. And I thought, well, that would be what he could sing about at the top of Act Two, that he can't sleep. I only need to change a few words at the top and make it be that he has insomnia because of guilt rather than because of love. And then change some of the topical references from English to New Orleans. And you have another major pattern song for the major general that makes total sense within the story that Gilbert was telling. And so that's another edition of stealing.
Shame unremitting robs me of my rest. I told a lie, my blame's beyond redeeming. Guilt, nightmare-like, lies heavy on my chest and weaves itself into my evening's dreaming. You're lying awake with a dismal headache and repose is tabooed by anxiety. I believe you may use any language you choose to indulge in without impropriety. For your brain is on fire, the bedclothes conspire of usual slumber to plunder you. First your comforter goes and uncovers your toes, then your sheet slips demurely from under you. The blanketing tickles, you feel like mixed pickles, so terribly sharp is the pricking. And you're hot and you're cross and you tumble and toss till there's nothing twixt you and the ticking. Then the bedclothes all creep to the ground in a heap and you pick them all up in a tangle. Next your pillow resigns and politely declines to remain at its usual angle. Will you get some repose in the form of a doze with hot eyeballs and head ever aching? But your slumbering teems were such horrible dreams, it would very much better be waking. For you dream you are crossing the ocean and tossing about in a ship you disparage, which is something between a large rowing machine and a very small second-class carriage. And you're giving a treat, etouffee and pig's feet, to a party of friends and relations. They're a ravenous horde, and they all came on board at Marrero and Methodist stations. And bound on that journey, you find your attorney, who's there like an angel from heaven. He's a bit undersized, and you don't feel surprised when he tells you he's only 11. When you're driving like mad with this singular lad. By the by, the ship's now a four-wheeler. And you're playing card games, and he calls you bad names when you tell him that ties pay the dealer. But this you can't stand, so you throw up your hand, and you find you're as cold as an icicle. In your shirt and your socks, the black silk with gold clocks, crossing Lake Pontchartrain on a bicycle. When to your dismay, several great birds of prey fly you off, lacking drink you are thirsty for, and you find you've agreed to premiere as the lead of a ballet that you've not rehearsed before. So to soften your shock, you all dance Offenbach in a can-can that no man should tarry on. Make a grand pirouette like a marionette as the dancers cry,
keep calm and carry on.
Then from the right wing swings the bold pirate king, who's determined to give you a shake again. Sticks a sword in your ribs as he cries, you told fibs. And then just as you die, you're awake again. You're a regular wreck with a crick in your neck, and no wonder you snore, for your head's on the floor, and you've needles and pins reassert to your shins, and your flesh is a creep, for your left leg's asleep. You've crap in your toes and a fly in your nose, fluff in your lung and a feverish tongue, and a thirst that's intense and a general sense that you haven't been sleeping in clover. But it's not as it seemed, diddly squat, what you dream, though the nightmare was long, ditto, ditto, my song. And thank goodness they're both of them over.
opening number was a drinking song, which is not about much in the show, in the original show. And Frederick, although he has solo moments in singing ballads, he doesn't have like a kind of who I am and this is what I'm about, which is would be a normal expectation for a show that is centered around this one character and his dilemma. And so I took a song called Good Morrow, Good Mother from Iolanthe and changed it to Good Morning, My Brothers, and combined that with the drinking song to make a new, livelier and jazzier opening number for the show. And it seemed to work just fine, combining those two different Sullivan songs and jazzing them up. So these are some of the changes that were made. Mm-hmm. There are many more, but those right. are three ones that are very standout on the album as things you won't hear on any other recording of Pirates of Penzance.
Yeah, and there's a few characters who are missing, which yeah. it's, but to be honest with you, in a lot of Gilbert and Sullivan, there sometimes are these I don't want to call them extraneous, but there are several secondary characters who don't have a lot to do, but they're there.
Yeah.
And they kind of don't necessarily add a lot. So removing them is not that noticeable unless you're someone who played that role in high school or college and you're sitting there going, wait, there's no Samuel, or wait, there's no, you know, you just kind of go,
well, Samuel, he speaks up in the opening number, and I never understand why, because the Pirate King is in the opening number, which I didn't think was a good idea, because you have the Pirate King, who's this dominating presence in the show. And in the opening number that Gilbert and Sullivan wrote, he's singing along with his men, and Samuel's doing a lot of the talking. And you think, but you're wasting this character. He's just passive for two numbers.
Right.
So I gave him his own entrance, using some of the spirit of a segment of Rudagore that lent itself well to the ship entering. And so he gets his own entrance song. With a calypso bridge to it at one point. Samuel in the, he sings this song about distributing weapons of burglary. And I thought, that's all well and good, but we don't care. We don't know who Samuel is. We don't care about him. And they never perform the burglary in any version of it. Mm-hmm. He's bucket and here's your, and I said that the person who should be singing that is the Pirate King. And once I eliminate Samuel from the opening number and from that number and put Pirate King in there, I suddenly think, well, is there any reason to have Samuel around? No, I guess there isn't. Bye, Sam.
Yeah. Well, this like I said, that's why it's not called The Pirates of Penzance.
It's called
Pirates, the Penzance Musical.
We couldn't bring ourselves to actually call it Pirates of Penzance because we thought, we have made changes to this, and it's its own flavor, its own creature.
Yeah.
And so we thought that Pirates, with the subtitle, The Penzance Musical, so that anyone who knew of the Pirates of Penzance would say, oh, it must be some version of that. Mm-hmm. And it is some version of that.
It's still the same basic plot. I mean, it's still, and also, as you said, it has its own flavor, which brings me to the music.
Yep.
And the arrangements. Talk a little bit about that, because one of the things I found fascinating about listening to the cast recording is that it has a distinct New Orleans jazz Caribbean feel to it, but at the same time, there are many numbers on the album that you still hear the strains of Gilbert and Sullivan. You still hear the operatic arrangements of the songs. So you won't, I mean, they're not so distorted that they don't sound like the original stuff you're used to hearing. It's some of them are more so than others, but it flows really beautifully. So that it's not so jolting that things are so different. You still feel like you're listening to Pirates.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, I hope it does. I happen to agree with you. That was our goal from the outset, that we weren't there to do a hatchet job on it. We were there to just to give it a different setting. Mm-hmm. But still, first of all, Solomon's melodies are almost entirely intact.
Mm-hmm.
We've given it some, occasionally put some things in there, harmonically that reflect this new setting for the show. They're bluesy chords, but the melody that's being sung against them is the same. We made a couple of rules for ourselves. The first was Gilbert announces at the beginning of the show, you're told, that Gilbert will play the modern major general himself.
Oh, okay.
And so it's to, and it's almost as if to say, look, I wrote that patter song. No one's going to, I know how it should go. And so we made a rule that when Gilbert was singing, we should try our very best to keep it almost verbatim. So the modern major general is only different from any other recording you would hear of it from David Hyde Pierce's wonderful interpretation of it, which is completely right in the zone of any traditional performance, but just masterful. And one or two ad libs that he threw in where there had been ad libs anyway. And by the way, just for any purists out there, almost everybody that performs Gilbert and Sullivan alters stuff. NIGASP, the New York Gilbert and Sullivan players, they write whole routines into the show that should be in a burlesque show, not in Gilbert and Sullivan. So it's not like we're the first people to ever goose this stuff a little bit. You know?
Oh, absolutely. I did a production of Pinafore that was done in the style of Drood. In the sense that it was done as pantomime.
Oh, my God.
Yes, it had a master of ceremonies, like host guy, who narrated the whole thing. Yes, and Buttercup was a guy, and Rafe was was a pants roll, was a woman in pants, was a man.
This is so wonderful. I not only love your show, but now I can sue you.
I was only working on the production. I wasn't involved, but.
I was an employee, but
it wasn't. No, there was no mention of Drew, but it was done as a British.
It was done as
a pantomime, and it worked beautifully as a pantomime. It was funnier.
But those are liberties that are taken.
Yeah.
And my brother is when he performs, he's done almost every major role in every major Gilbert and Sullivan operetta, and he's always writing. Helping the comedy along a little, coming in with it. I'll say, oh, well, that's you writing, right? And he said, yes, I had to get a laugh there somehow. So, yeah. Now, what were we talking about, though? Gilbert, we decided, rule one was when Gilbert's singing, if at all possible, except at the very end of the show, towards the end, he's kind of caught the jazz bug himself. And hearing all this jazz, he has a little go of it a couple of times himself where he says, well, I think I can master that. I may have been in England all these years, but I think I can do it. So it's fun, but we do some very traditional treatments. But there were other times where we said, don't want to change a note, but do want to change the feeling of it. And so one of my goals going into this, and Joseph Joubert did such a masterful job with this, in both his arranging and orchestrating, one of my goals was... Even Linda Ronstadt, when she sang Poor Wandering One in the 1980s version, it was always done. It's always done as the show-off coloratura coquette number. You don't want to hear me imitate that, but it's always got that section that goes,
yeah,
like that. And I thought, if I could turn Poor Wandering One into a torch song, we're doing something interesting. And so Samantha Williams does the most amazing job of bringing a kind of lusty vibrance to the number that it's never, ever had. And yet it's as beautiful in this interpretation, I think, as any soprano has ever done in doing it more traditional way. So, again, it's respectful, but it is making you hear it in a way you never heard it before.
Poor wandering one.
such a poor love as mine can help thee find true peace of mind. Why, take it, it is thine.
Take heart, rain ends in flowers. Take any heart but not ours.
Take heart, the days will shine. Take any heart, take
She's definitely not a traditional Mabel.
No.
At all.
In the relationship, she's the strong one. She's Frederick is sort of wrapping himself around her little finger.
Yeah.
So
when you jumped into, I'm just curious, off just a little bit of a tangent, I guess, when you jumped into the text, I mean, this is your first time. I know you were a GNS aficionado,
right,
in many ways, but this is your first time actually jumping in and revising Gilbert and Sullivan,
yeah,
show. So that's sort of like taking apart an automobile and like putting it back together a little bit, mm-hmm, taking apart something like that. Was there anything that surprised you as you were kind of dismantling the show and putting it back together that like maybe increased your admiration for Gilbert and Sullivan's original work?
Absolutely. Some of our biggest laughs, mm-hmm, and I say this in full humility. I even have trouble saying humility. Some of our biggest laughs were jokes that William Schwenk Gilbert wrote in 1880. Mm-hmm. Now, that's pretty damn good. Mm-hmm. You write a joke in 1880, and it's funny in 2025, mm-hmm, without any context. One of the things I think in terms of adapting, one of the things I'm grateful for is that I am a musician. And I did an interview in the Times in which they asked me in conjunction with the novel, A Murder Your Employer. They asked me if there were many writers who were also musicians. And I said, I think all good writers are musicians. They all have their own rhythm and language and punctuate. I said, someone once asked me if I could make Glengarry Glen Ross into a musical, and I answered seriously, Glengarry Glen Ross is a musical. That they are singing.
Uh-huh.
It uh-huh. is sometimes some of them are tone deaf, and their tunes are maybe unpleasant to hear. But and so I feel I've been lucky in that. Whenever I've had to write in a lot of different voices in my career. I've had to write as Charles Dickens and be credible. Mm-hmm. I've had to write as Oscar Wilde, as Patty Chayefsky, as George Burns. Mm-hmm. When I wrote the Say Goodnight Gracie about the life of George Burns, I started to develop a stutter that, mm-hmm, that he would have, and he would say, Gracie didn't. I'm not an impressionist, but I could hear his rhythms. you know, say, "Ah, oh, Gracie, Gracie would do." And in the much the same way that Humphrey Bogart always repeated pronouns, he'd always say, you thought you had me there, but I know that. I know
mm-hmm,
that.
Mm-hmm.
And I can hear the music of these people. So when I write as Jerry Lewis, and Miss Parody, I believe that you'll find it. When I have to write that way, I can kind of hear them. And I started to hear Gilbert. And sometimes, for example, there's an exchange between Modern Major General and the Pirate King. And what he wrote was hilarious in 1880. And it was not, it was great nonsense comedy, like George Burns and Gracie Allen. And I thought, I want this to go on a little longer. We're just getting started with this exchange. And so I then extended it, keying out of the tone and the rhythm that he had established. I said, as a musician, I think I know how I can have a first ending and a second ending and a dies ad quota to this. And so we have what used to be a 4-line exchange suddenly was now a 16-line exchange, and the laughs only built and built more. That made me so revere what Gilbert had done in the first place, because when I did it, I was extending what he established. What he did was invented out of nothing.
Right.
And there had not been much of that type of comedy before. Mm-hmm. He believed, he loved the same thing that George Burns loved, which was illogical logic. I wrote two lines for Say Goodnight, Gracie. One is that Gracie put the salt in the pepper shaker and the pepper in the salt shaker so that when she was wrong, she'd be right. The other one was, I'm not making egg salad anymore because I looked, egg salad is made from eggs and mayonnaise, but I looked at a jar of mayonnaise and what's it made with? Eggs. So why bother? Okay. Now, one of those is real Gracie Allen and one of them is my Gracie Allen. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anyone can tell which is which.
Right.
Same thing with Gilbert. I once said to a director who said, you know, I'm sort of the co-author of this piece. And I who had spent 3 years typing it, suddenly thought, gee, I didn't know you were in the room with me. And I said, a director is someone who can take a humdrum potato and manage to transform it into a delicious sizzling plate of French fries. And a writer is someone who can make a potato out of thin air.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
So I was doing the French fries part of it.
Right.
And it made me so respect Gilbert. Every time he gave me something, I thought, God, if you were Neil Simon sitting in the room with me and you said, as a show doctor, you know, that's, you got to go with that joke. I would feel the same way about Gilbert. He did it when it wasn't common. People took themselves very seriously. He refused to take anything seriously. And then he clung, in the old rule of farce, he clung to his, he would have an absurd premise. In this case, a boy is apprenticed into being a pirate instead of as a pilot of a ship. And the whole play keys off of his inability to abandon that commitment. The subtitle of Pirates of Penzance was The Slave of Duty. And that's what Frederick is. He cannot, and every time there's something that he wants to do, he can't do it because of his sense of duty. And it's ridiculous. Anyone else would abandon it. Gilbert, in inventing that conceit, said, we're going to keep true to it all the way through. And it just makes the job of comedy writing that much easier when someone's done so much hard work and so much invention to begin with.
Oh, is there not one maiden blessed could take with grace my glad affection? Although the world may claim you're blessed with homely face and bad complexion, of such a one, if such there be, I swear by heaven's arch above you, if you will cast your eyes on me, however plain you be, I'll love you. However plain you be, if you will cast your eyes on me, however plain you be, I'll love you. I'll love you. I'll love.
Let's move to a completely different topic, because we're almost out of time. But what is next for you? I know you've got a lot of things. You always have a lot of things going on, it seems. Do we have, is there any news on, you mentioned Jerry Lewis. Is there any news on The Nutty Professor? Is there any news on, I have always been a big fan of Remember When.
Oh, thank you.
That one of the greatest TV shows ever. Seriously, if people can find it, Remember When somewhere, it's just an amazing. And I wish there was a recording of the songs. I wish somebody would. If there was an ability of going into a recording studio and just doing an album of all the songs that were written for Remember When, that would be amazing to do sometime.
So that means a great deal to me. Remember When, W-E-N-N, not W-H-E-N, W-E-N, yeah. Said in 1939 at a small under sponsored radio station in Pittsburgh. That was the greatest gig I'll ever have in my life, because I created the series. This was the first series AMC did before Mad Men.
Mm-hmm.
We had no budget to work on. Gorgeous period costuming and photography, and a brilliant cast, mainly a Broadway player. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If we had a guest star, it was somebody who was on Broadway at that time. So we had Betty Buckley and Donna Murphy and Jason Alexander as guest stars. Roddy McDowell's last TV show, who was brilliant in it. But as my reward for writing, there were 56 scripts, of which I wrote 54.
Mm-hmm.
And my reward for writing the scripts was that I also got to write all the music for the series. And I had the joy that very few screenwriters ever get, which is that when I would type a speech at the end, a sentimental speech, I would think, and I'm going to bring the strings in right there, and I'll melt everyone's heart with that. And so it was just a privilege. And I was the lone writer, and so the stories were mine. I had a continuing storyline, and I never told the network what it was. They just learned what it was as I delivered it. They were a fledgling network, and they would give me notes on my script, and I'd say, these are wonderful notes. These changes are fabulous. Unfortunately, we filmed the episode yesterday. And so I was sort of like, it was like someone let me into the funhouse and left the lights on and let me have my way with everything. So yeah, I loved writing, and I got to write for singers like Donna Murphy, for Amanda Norton, Carolee Carmello, Mary Stout, Betty Buckley came into the Christmas episode. You were saying, if you can find a copy, I will say, and that none of this was planned in this interview, so I'm not here to promote Remember When. I get nothing out of this. But if you do want to ever see this series, it was a wonderful period series, kind of lend me a tenor every single week.
Mm-hmm.
It is available on AMC Plus, and if you want to get it, I recommend you not get it from AMC Plus, but rather through Amazon Prime, because the interface that AMC Plus has is hopeless. But if you go to Amazon Prime and look for Remember When, they've upgraded all the visual qualities, best the series has ever looked.
Oh, wow.
And it's got absolutely accurate subtitles, which no one ever does anymore, closed caption titles, and the audio is as good as it can ever be. And if you don't want to do that, someone illegally, I think, is airing, putting all of them on YouTube under the name of Antenna TV. I don't think they have any right to be doing it. By the way, those visuals aren't good. They look like VHS recordings, but it is all out there, so you can see it. It's one of my three favorite works that I've ever created.
Fantastic.
The other, History of Edwin Drood, and the third I will not name because it has to be, that slot has to be anything I'm promoting.
Right. At the moment, yes.
I'm writing a sequel to Murder Your Employer right now, it's going to be called Murder Your Mate, and I am finishing my musical that I've been writing for 20 years now, based on the picture of Dorian Gray. I realize that many people have written musicals and stage plays of Dorian Gray. This one, I think, is some of the best writing I've ever done, certainly since Mystery of Edwin Drood. So that's keeping me busy.
Terrific. Well, I look forward to seeing and hearing whatever you have coming out. And hopefully you will come back to do some promotion work.
Absolutely.
But I highly recommend the album, cast album for Pirates, the Penzance musical, which is available on Center Stage Records. It is out as of today when it starts streaming on Center Stage Records. So you can get it on CD if you want physical CDs. It's been available digitally for a few weeks now. It's a lot of fun, fantastic cast. And I think you'll really, really love it because it's just a whole new take on Pirates of Penzance. And it's a lot of fun to listen to. I had a great time. So thank you so much, Rupert, for taking the time today.
My pleasure. It was a joy.
I am the Pirate King.
He is the last Pirate King.
From fair Aruba heading for Cuba, I'll see my flag and sing.
Oh, damn the Pirate King.
They shrink to think of the Pirate King. Their hearts will fail, they quake and they quail.
And I'll hail the Pirate King.
Ah, well, that's all you got. Doing. Oh, better far to live and die. Under the pirate flag I fly. My crew are true and loyal to me, and I'm piratical royalty.
Oh, hello.
When I raise anchor to seek my prey, I help myself in a royal way. The Navy hunts me, but I guffaw. Possession is 10 tens of pirate lore. And that's what's keeping me king.
We're loving the Pirate King.
All ships are fleeing the Caribbean each time they hear me sing. I am the Pirate King.
Yes, it's good when you are the king.
Though the throne is lonely, I own it only. It's mine, cause I'm the king. My father was a pirate like me. Plundering runs in the family. And I'm a king-sized headache for some. Raiding galleons and running rum. To meet my sailor, all dock and fear. Come greet your neighborhood buccaneer. What name in this great democracy can lay claim to be aristocracy?
The king.
To true, it's you who is Pirate King. We'll grant panache, I buckle
and swash. Oh my gosh!
I'm Pirate King, I'll have my final fling.
While we are tied to your apron string.
My reputation needs a vacation, but I'm the Pirate King. A Spanish galleon's calling to across the Caribbean Sea. The ship, she sighs, a treasure of gold awaits your pleasure within my hold. I love the bays of New Orleans.
Good. Oh, all right now.
But sadly lack the ways and means. A man of leisure I'd love to be. But I hear my shipmates are calling me. So I'm still the Pirate King.
Yes, as mentioned, the Pirate King.
The anachronistic and narcissistic, but not sadistic king. I'll live and die as a king.
So then you'll die as a Pirate King.
The swank, top ranking. Walking the planking, the once and final.